If you guys would come up a little closer to the front, we wouldn't have to use the mic to start. But you tell us when we need to use the mic, please. I'd like to introduce Nathan Lowell, who is our guest of honor. And we are so delighted to have you here.
Really,
Local Boy Makes
here.
Good.
Yeah.
I was going to start by saying I started reading your books before I met you, because two very close friends of mine on the East Coast, who I think possibly had met you at Balticon, both sent me a recommendation, and one of them sent me actually a copy of your first book and said, you must read this. So when I got an email from you, because I was doing programming for Cosign, that said, hi, my name is Nathan Lowell, I've written some books and I'd like to be on your panels, I said, oh my God, it's that famous person. Come on down front. And I was thrilled. So I just wanted you to know that from the beginning. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your background in education, where you were born, what you did, how it's changed?
I started out in rural Maine in a small town just outside Portland, Maine, just off the coast. I was very young as a child.
Really?
Yep, and I've grown somewhat older and probably not really a lot wiser since.
How about the beard? Did you have that as a
child? I did not have that. This is recent. This is actually only a few years old.
Okay.
But we were poor, blue-collar, typical rural Maine folk. Identified very closely with the ocean. One of my first jobs was working on a factory. One of my second jobs was working on a fishing boat. So when it came time for me to graduate from high school, I went into the service and joined the Coast Guard in order to avoid the rice paddies. Mm-hmm. Spent 5 years in the Guard, got out, worked in college bookstores for a while. I always wanted to write. I started writing when I was very young. Somewhere, I hope, moldering in a landfill, are the spiral-bound notebooks that I filled with deathless prose. I started out wanting to be a writer and really never figured it would happen. You're not really an artist. The life of an artist isn't something. The life of an artist isn't really something that you think about.
Is that on?
No.
Yeah.
There might be a clip right on it.
It says on.
Oh.
It's not on.
I don't think you need it.
All right.
So it's the big thing for me growing up was, what are you going to do when you grow up? What job are you going to have? How are you going to make a living? How are you going to feed yourself? How are you going to keep a roof over your head? And so it was very much a vocational orientation, and the idea that I might be a writer, that I might be an artist, was sort of, well, yeah, you can do that on the side, but how are you going to make a living? Because there's a reason that we call them starving artists, and you don't want to be starving. So, yeah, that was sort of the root. So for me to be sitting here now as guest of honor, author in a convention is sort of like, whoa.
Tell me about your education, post-high school.
Post-high school. Okay, I started, when I got out of the Guard, I was Vietnam-era vet, so I had really good GI Bill benefits. I started college in computer science. I was a first semester junior in computer science at the University of Southern Maine when the boss gave me an ultimatum, which was either continue working or continue going to school. And so I kept working. It was 14 years later before I was able to get back into college, and I finished up at the Millard Fillmore School of Business at SUNY Buffalo and graduated there in 92. With a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration and a minor in Marketing.
And see, he's admitted it. Marketing. Yeah, marketing. He said the word.
I said it. The M word. 10 years later, we were here in Colorado. We were living in Greeley, and I had a really bad internet addiction. And the only way I could get internet access in Greeley at the time was to be a student at UNC. So I enrolled at UNC and took a bunch of courses. Anything that didn't have a prerequisite, that didn't require me to matriculate, that all I had to do was pay my fee and show up. I took all kinds of really interesting things. I took an orienteering class from one of the guys from Canada, from the National Outdoor Learning School. That was fascinating. It was great stuff. I learned a lot of really interesting things that had absolutely no bearing on anything. And then eventually I wound up in a class called Computers in Education, mm-hmm. taught by Dr. Hill. And Dr. Hill showed up in class, and I thought Dr. Hill was the TA.
Young.
Very young, very short, very slim, cropped hair, three piercings in this ear, one in her nose, and she wheeled in this big cart that was like four times bigger than she was, and she started setting up. And I'm sitting there in the class thinking, wow, this is pretty cool. Dr. Hill must be somebody. Got a TA mm-hmm, to do mm-hmm. the setup for her. And she goes back out of the room and comes back with two milk crates full of crap, and she brings them in and slaps them down. And she's looking around and checking out, making sure the computer is connected and the thing is mm-hmm. showing. And then she starts to teach. And I realize, you're an idiot, because that's Dr. Hill. And I took a couple classes with Dr. Hill, and it came to the point where I had to either enroll in the master's program in educational technology or find some other program that I could lurk in and keep my internet addiction going. So I figured any department that would have somebody as cool as that as a teacher was something that I wanted to do. So I started in a master's program in technology and educational technology, graduated in 98, started a PhD program in 99, got my PhD in 2004, and taught for a couple of years. Spent 13 years working for the National Center on Severe and Sensory Disabilities, inventing ways for people who are blind and visually impaired to use the graphical environment that we know as the World Wide Web. And got interested in distance technology, which is why I got into podcasting.
Which is the next one on our list here that we went over.
Yep.
I wanted you to talk a little bit about working with distance education and what that taught you about social media.
Oh, yeah. Distance education was really fascinating. on the one hand, it taught me a lot about education, because education and their research and how they determine what things work and how things work was very... It had a certain amount of rigor, and I really appreciated the rigor. But the problem with it was that they could only answer the questions they were asking. And so a lot of times the questions carried a bias that wasn't really considered. So one of the things that I learned early on in my distance program was that online courses alienated and isolated students. And the dropout rates were huge. 75%, 90% was not uncommon. Because students would log into these classes and feel cut off from everybody, which seemed really odd to me, because being on the internet is how I stay connected, not how I stay isolated. I'm isolated when I log off, not when I log on. So it was very curious to me. And so I asked them to show me the research, and I read the research, and the research actually proved that they were creating courses that isolated students. So they were actually doing what they set out to do, which was to isolate students, and they didn't realize that what they were doing was purposefully isolating students, and that there were alternatives that they could use instead. But because they were educators, because one of their main concepts is classroom control, when students are in class, you want them to pay attention to what's going on in the classroom. You don't want them skylarking and talking with each other and passing notes and all the rest of the stuff. You want them to be paying attention to what the teacher is saying. They want to be paying attention to the content, and completely overlooking the fact that a lot of the reason people go to class is to sit next to the cute person next to them. And if you cut that out, if you take out that part of the educational process, you've taken off a really strong motivator for making people show up. And it's really hard to teach them if they don't show up. So it was fascinating for me to work with these educators who had no idea why people were isolated, and no idea that the reason it was isolated was because they were creating environments that enforced the isolation, because they were trying to deal with this idea of classroom control, not understanding that by over-controlling the classroom, they were in fact hampering the education that they were offering.
So you've done a lot of work with social media.
I've done a lot of work with social media. I've been working with social media before it was social media.
Right. So talk a little bit, if you would, about social media, non-geographic affinity, And how that has influenced your readership.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that struck me early on in my education career was that I could be closer to a guy who was sitting in an office in Syracuse than I could be to the woman who was sitting across the hall from me in Greeley. And I started looking at, why was that the case? Because obviously in-person communication is superior, correct? No, not really. It has a lot to do with, do you have a connection that goes beyond happening to be in the same room? Do we go beyond the can I smell you idea? And what I discovered, there was a whole series of connectability issues that involve outlook, involve, in many cases, really simple things like immediacy. If I talk to you and you have to wait for 3 hours to get an answer, or if I talk to you and I have to wait 3 hours for you to answer me, I'm not going to be as close to you as somebody who answers me right away. So if we're having a conversation here, this is immediacy. There's another concept of immediacy that has to do with the language that we use. So if we use the language, there's a certain level of immediacy because we are. If you use the language that's different from me, that's a distancing kind of construct. That kind of construct is used very often in classroom and in online education. So this us-them idea versus the we idea is also part of this construct called immediacy. Immediacy is very important for making connection, in large part because the longer you have to wait, the less immediate things are, and it makes it much more difficult to have a conversation. It makes it much less difficult to make a connection. And there's another one called social presence. Social presence is the one that I really glommed onto. Social presence is, it has come to mean the degree of salience in an interaction. So it's how are you, how much there are you? So a wallflower, this classic wallflower, sits in the back, never says anything, nobody knows, very low social presence. That's the example. The guy dancing on the coffee table with the lampshade on his head is a very high social presence. So those two extremes sort of underscore some of the difficulty that we have with social presence, and that it's possible to have very high social presence that you really don't want. Mm-hmm. And it's also possible to have very low social presence, and if it's really low, nobody knows you. You're not there. So somewhere in between the guy with the lampshade and the guy sitting in the back behind the potted plant, there's some balance between that. The interesting thing to me, from a technology standpoint, mm-hmm. was that social presence came out of some research done by Short, Williams, and Christie for British Telecom in the 90s, when they were trying to sell the idea of video conferencing to businesses as a way to reduce the amount of expense of business travel. And what they came up with this term of social presence, which was the theoretical maximum capability of a particular channel to transmit social cues. So if you think about it in terms of a telephone, if you're on the telephone and you do this, the person on the other end doesn't know what's going on. So over time, we've developed fluency in using the phone. Mm-hmm. And so, just like you're doing right there, we make little sounds. And those sounds actually facilitate communication. They don't they don't impair it. The idea is, well, that's a noise that's interfering, so that's noise versus signal. But in a communication structure, what that is letting me know that you are hearing me and I can continue on my conversation. I can continue with what I'm saying. If I'm talking and I'm not getting anything back, I don't know if the connection is still there, if you're still listening, if I suddenly, the phone line has gone dead and I haven't noticed or whatever. So they came up with this idea of this theoretical maximum. And where it falls down is that it overlooks the reality that we as humans adapt our communications to the channels that we're using. And the more fluent we are with the channel, like a telephone, we adapt our behaviors and our communications in order to take advantage of that. From an educational standpoint, that was really big for me because in social media in particular, mm-hmm. it helped me understand that there's more to it than just, do I put up a blog post? Or do I post on Twitter? Or do I do Facebook? And what those channels facilitate and the modes and means of communications on those channels.
And the next thing that we're going to talk about in just one second is how You started your writing essentially through podcasting.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about how the social media and podcasting increased your audience. But first I would like to ask Eric if you could go up and get Ted to come and turn the electronics on.
Sure.
Thank you.
You want me to hit the power button?
Wait a minute, Eric. Pat, could you hit the power button?
Hit the right button.
Is this working now?
It's on FM, though.
Okay. You may need Ted to, or you figure it out. Yeah. I'll just leave this to you all.
Okay.
We're fiddling with that a lot.
No,
I'll just go get Ted.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead and turn it back off. Pat.
Hello.
There we go. We'll wait for them. So you can go ahead. So what we want to talk about now is you came into writing science fiction through a different channel than many people.
Yeah,
and
that's
you
safe
came
to say.
In through podcasting.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to talk a little bit about both podcasting and how you started your first book that way.
Yeah.
And segue into how your social media use increased your audience.
Okay. You'll have to keep me on track.
Yes, sir. I will do that.
Okay. So.
You have 10 minutes.
All right. No pressure. In 2006, I was looking at podcasting as a way to get high bandwidth content to distance education people who didn't have high bandwidth pipes. There's a lot of America is still on 56 kilobit dial-up. In 2007, it was a lot more. And so we were reaching out to people who were in Alaska, to people who were in upstate Minnesota, to people who they were lucky to have a phone line, let alone a high-speed bandwidth. And getting high bandwidth content to them, getting audio to them, getting video to them was a challenge. And so I was looking at podcasting to find a way, a mechanism to get to offload the download times to off-peak so that they could have their computer log in at midnight and download their lesson for the next day, and they would have it ready for them in high bandwidth mode. In order to do that, I had to know how podcasting really worked, and not just from the standpoint of, well, you have to have a feed, and you have to have this, and you have to have that, and you need to have audio, you need to have whatever it is you want to deliver. I wanted to know, how does this work? How do we make this fly? What makes a podcast actually go? And in order to do that, I needed to start a podcast. I needed to do it in order to learn how it worked. And so at that point, I had been listening to audiobooks, and I had listened to every audiobook, and there were only 98 of them. Well, Quarter Share was number 98. So there weren't that many. It didn't take me that long to read them, listen to them all. And so one of the things that happened along that way was that I discovered that these people were having fun. This was a hoot. This was a party, and I wanted to play. And so I said, well, if I'm going to do this, then I have to write a book. And I always wanted to write. I mean, I've wanted to write since I was in junior high. And I always wanted to write science fiction, because science fiction is what I know, because it's what I read. And science fiction was the first book I remember checking out of the library, because it had the little rocket ship on the spine. So science fiction was the choice. And so having read science fiction all my life, it was like, okay, well, what kind of science fiction am I going to write? And so I had to figure out, what if we sent freighters instead of frigates? Mm-hmm. What did the red-shirted crewman do before he got tapped for the away team? Who took his place when he was killed? I mean, what happened to the ship? They didn't send down to HR and hire another... What happened? You know, how did that work? So I came up with this idea that I was going to write this other kind of story that wasn't blow up something every 15 pages and save the universe every 50. And can I make that compelling if it's not blowing something up? Is there anything that's interesting about not blowing up? And so I started out, and January 12th, 2007, and I only know that because I have it posted on, I have the date stamp on my wiki, I wrote Call Me Ishmael. Mm-hmm. And 10 days later, I stood up, 76,000 words. Second draft was 5 days later, third draft was 3 days after that. I started recording it and posting it and putting it out on Podiobooks. It took me about 90 days to get 100 listeners. I had 1,000 by the end of the year. At this point, across all the titles, all the episodes of all the books, 9.896 million downloads.
Wow.
So, yeah, we're closing in. If I had gotten, I think if I'd gotten Zephyr's call recorded, I'd be over 10 million right now, but I've been busy. Yeah, it's close to 10 million downloads across all the episodes. It's something over 120 hours of finished audio. It's all free. You can get it. It's on iTunes. It's at pottybooks.com. Ding. But what that is a very... Podcasting in those days, a lot of people still think you needed to have an iPod to listen to podcasts because it's pod. And so there was a lot of work on social media to make people understand that all you needed was an MP3 player, and you could listen to all of this great free content. And there were a lot of people who were putting out all kinds of shows, radio shows, talk shows, sport shows, all kinds of stuff. But this fiction market was one that I operated in, and I didn't have a separate feed, I didn't have a separate place where you could get it. You had to get it from Pottybooks, and Pottybooks bleeds into iTunes seamlessly, so if it's on Pottybooks, it's on iTunes. And I spent a lot of time working in social media to connect with the people who were saying, hey, this is pretty cool. This is a different kind of story. This isn't normal. And in some cases that was, hey, that's good, this isn't normal. In some cases it was, really? This isn't normal. I spent a lot of time working in social media, primarily Twitter in the early days. A lot of us, a lot of the Pottybooks authors in particular, worked on Twitter to connect with the listeners. We call them readers because they're audiobooks. And so if I talk about a reader, it's hard to tell whether you're talking about somebody who's got it on an ebook or a paperback or listens to it. I've got 106,000 people have downloaded the first episode of Quarter Share, and 65,000 have downloaded the last episode of Owner Share. So it's pretty good throughput. I haven't sold that many paperbacks in the share books. So there's not a lot of overlap between the two audiences, but there's enough bleed over that the people who listen to it talk about it. And audio is not for everybody. Everybody can deal with audio. They really need to have the book that they can read. And I guess some of the people who do audio do both. I've had people call me or write to me and say, you know, I bought the book so that I could hear, I could read it in my own voice, and now I'm reading it, I'm hearing you. So thanks a lot.
Talk a little bit. We talked this morning, and you were talking about how the people who read your books in a particular audience, usually science fiction or fantasy, who they share with and how you... your works are self-advertising in some way through your audience.
I follow a strategy called 1,000 True Fans, and unlike the original formulation of the 1,000 True Fan strategy, which held that if you had 1,000 people who would spend $100 a year on your work every year, then you could make a living as an artist. And you only needed 1,000. I have a different formulation, and that's that 1,000 True Fans are the 1,000 salesmen that you couldn't afford to hire. I have a launch strategy that baffles most people in terms of marketing. My launch strategy is I send out one email to my list, or 1,700 people on my list, and over the course of 5 days, most of them open it. The majority of them will click the link. I don't know how many of them actually buy the book because it's scattered over time, and I don't see, you know, what that direct correlation is. The next day, I will post one post on my blog saying the book is available. I do not do pre-orders. I do not do, it's going to be out next week. No. I don't publish a link until the book is available. If you can't buy it, I won't tell you. I won't tell you when it's going to be due. I no longer tell people it'll be out next month, or it'll be out next week, or it'll be out tomorrow. Because A, it's way too random to actually predict too well, and it just pisses them off if they want to click the link and they can't buy it. I can't tell you the number of times I've gotten links. It's like, oh, this sounds pretty interesting. I'm going to click the link. It will be available next month. Okay, well, next month maybe I'll remember. So I don't do that. If you hear from me that a book is out, it's out. You can buy it. You can get it. And there'll be a link that says where. And then probably you can get it someplace else too. But I don't tell people until it's out. And I don't tell people more than once. So I post one email, one blog, And then the third day, I tweet once, and the link is available, and I put the link up and say, the book is out. And by the time I actually post the Twitter link, 42 other people have already gotten the email or read the blog post or posted it on Twitter. It's already on Facebook. It's already making the rounds of the faithful who say, I found it, it's out, it's here, it's ready. My stalkers find me and find the book and tell everybody else it's out. And the reason they do that is they know that I'm not going to tell them. And I do that on purpose. It's a trifle manipulative, perhaps, but the reality is I don't want to be the guy standing on the coffee table with the lampshade on my head saying, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book. I don't need to be, because I have 1,000 people right now. It's probably closer to 10,000 people. Just yesterday, one of my fans posted on Facebook, as he keeps quoting me and nobody gets it, and he wants to fix that. Okay, I can get behind that. It's can I send you a book? What do you need? How can we fix that? So yeah, I use social media sort of backwards. I post a picture most every day when I do my walk. I have a daily podcast, mm-hmm. and I post a picture, and it's just a picture. It's a picture, and it has like TMO. It's got a hashtag on it for my podcast, and it has a weather report, and it's the same picture every day, every single day. It's the same picture. It's there's a particular place in my neighborhood, and I go and I stand there, and it's one of these square pole signposts, and I put the camera up against it, and then I take the picture, and it's at sunrise because I walk in the morning. So I've got 957 sunrise pictures. And people, every once in a while, and I'll post that on Twitter, and I'll post it on mm-hmm. Google+. And every once in a while, somebody says, well, what the hell is this? What is this TMO? Well, I said, did you Google it? And if you Google the hashtag, it comes right up. Well, there's not that many people who do this. So it's really easy to find, and then they want to tell me that I'm doing social media wrong because I didn't put I should have put a link in, because if I put a link in, then everybody would know what it is. And I said, well, if I put a link in, it's an ad. And it's really not an ad. It's really the first word in a conversation that I'm having with my fans. It's the word that lets them know that I'm out and I'm walking, because I can't walk every day. I didn't walk today. I get sick. The weather is bad. I don't walk those days, and my fans know if we don't walk, I don't talk. Mm-hmm. If I don't talk, I don't record. If I don't record, there's not going to be a podcast that day. So the first word in my podcast is, I'm out, I'm walking, here's the picture that proves I'm there. And if I forget to file the podcast when I get home an hour later, they'll remind me.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit about, your podcasting is like a blog.
Yeah.
Okay. But your patio books
right.
are actually the books.
The patio books are the books. The audio, okay. The patio books are serialized audio. They're not audio books.
Right. They're books that are read.
They're books that are read.
Talk about your writing process and how you took 5 years to become an overnight success.
I wouldn't sell my books. I'd only give away the podcast. One of the things that was a big question in my mind was whether or not anybody would be interested in what I wrote, because I didn't want to write what everybody else was writing. I wanted to write the books that I wanted to read, but I couldn't find. And I thought, well, maybe there's a few people who want to do that. So I started writing for Patio Books. I started writing specifically knowing that they would never appear on the page, that they were books that I would have to read out loud, and that the listeners would have to be able to follow the story while they're driving to work. And then they wouldn't get the next chapter until they were driving home. And they wouldn't get the next chapter until they went back to work the next morning. And so each episode had to have enough in it that they would be able to do that while they were driving to work or running on their treadmill or whatever it was that they were doing, without having to fumble and back up and say, what did he say? What was that? How does that work? What does that go? So a lot of there's a fair amount of repetition, mm-hmm. but there has to be, in order for people to stay with the story when they're trying to listen to something over the course of several days, and all the only contact they have with it is what comes through their ears. And so I was writing stories that I was going to read aloud and then break into sections and then put onto the feed and have people download. Most of them will download them all at once and then, you know, binge feed on them, but that's, you know, you really are limited by when you can listen. And so people who have jobs where they can listen all day, they got through the books a lot faster. People who only listened on their commute and it was 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon, or half an hour in the morning, half an hour, they went through it a lot slower. But they were always built for audio. All the books have always been built for audio, except for the last two. Because I always, and those I will record, but I always started with this notion that my audience are the listeners. And the people who buy the books on the side, that's cool. And so when I put them in text format, I have to go through and change them.
How long did it take for you to move from purely audio to having some text format?
May 2010.
Okay, so 3 years.
I started in 2007,
mm-hmm.
and then I signed with Ryden Publishing in January of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I had 1 million downloads. It's insane. I also had fewer books, so there were fewer mm-hmm. episodes, so there were fewer downloads. But in May of 2010, Ryden came out with Quarter Share, and that was the first time it was available in any text format that somebody could read for themselves. So, 3 years.
Okay. What portion of your income, how does it break down between text format and audio format?
Audio is free. So I don't, at this point I haven't put a new file up in a long time, a couple, 3 years. So the donations, it's a donation model.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you like the story, throw a couple dollars in and
PayPal.
Mm-hmm. And 75% of it comes to me and 25% goes to keep audiobooks going. And I'm happy with that. That's cool. And I made more money in the contributions than most authors get in advances.
That's the point we want to kind of go to.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, I've actually turned down one of the bigs. I turned down two of the bigs. I got to the point where they offered me an advance, and I laughed. And then I realized they were serious. and I wrote back, and this is an email conversation back and forth, and I wrote back to the guy, and we were so far apart in terms of what I needed to have and what they were able to offer that I wrote back to the guy and said, we're clearly too far apart for even me to make a counter offer here. I'm going to have to withdraw the book. And 15 minutes later, can we talk on the phone? And we couldn't. He had no concept of just how valuable those properties were to me. Mm-hmm. And I really understood that they weren't that valuable to him. He couldn't afford to pay me what they were worth to me. And yeah, I mean, he was going to sell 100,000 copies, maybe. Mm-hmm. More likely he was going to sell 10,000 copies, which is a good month for me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's lifetime for him. And he just did not get it. Well, you're not selling that many paper. No, I'm selling 50 times more ebooks. When you sell that many ebooks, 1 in 50 is still a good amount of money. What did I say? 80 books? I sold 80 paperback books this month.
But how many ebooks?
I sold 80 ebooks yesterday.
Okay. So the majority of your income on your writing is coming from ebooks on Amazon?
Right now it's coming from ebooks. When I put out the new audiobooks and podcasts, I'll get probably something between 3,000 and 10,000
donations. And that's a fairly normal advance.
Actually, 10,000 is considered a really good advance these days.
Right.
The more norm is like 5.
Mm-hmm.
I would expect, well, between the two books, I certainly will get 10,000 donations for the audiobook.
Right.
And in the meantime, they're selling pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So you've done a non-typical publishing.
Yeah, that's safe to say.
Clearly, you have a huge audience of people who buy your books.
Yeah.
And yet, you're not eligible to be a CIFL member.
No, I can't afford to be a CIFL member.
Talk a little bit about what CIFL is and how one gets a membership and the status of it.
Yeah. CIFL is Science Fiction Writers of America. It's the premier author organization for people who write science fiction, fantasy, speculative fiction in the United States. And in order to become a member, I have to sell to specific markets in specific ways. So I can be a member for a year if I sell so many short stories to specific markets. I can be a member if I sell a novel to one of the list of approved
publishers.
And in looking at the list of publishers and looking at the contracts that come out of those publishers, some time ago I decided I had to make a decision between being a professional author mm-hmm. and being a full-time writer. And I chose to be a full-time writer. To become a CIFWA member would mean I'd need to get a day job to support my publishing habit. And that's, you know, that's just not going to happen. I have enough habits to support. I don't need another one. So, I've talked to some of the past presidents of CIFWA, and there's a lot of noise going around now because I'm not the only one who's out there making a living, comfortable, nice living.
Six figures?
Yeah. From my writing. There probably aren't 100 writers
no.
making that. I know 50 of them.
Okay.
And at least 25 of them are not full-time. They're not published through Random House. The most prolific one I know is her best year. I think she got like $750,000. Mm-hmm. That was a good year for her. She paid cash for a house on the ocean. I hate her. No, I don't. I don't. I love her. She's a good friend of mine, and we work together. And like any kind of self-owned, driven business, and this really is a business, you have good years and you have bad years. And last year wasn't actually a good year for me. It was okay. It wasn't a great year. It wasn't the best year I ever had. I'm looking forward to having better. I'm not really looking forward to giving that money to Macmillan or St. Martin's or any of those people. And if that means that I can't be a member of CIFWA, okay, I'm good. I'm okay with that. It's SFWA, which is why I keep pronouncing it CIFWA. I'm sorry. Science Fiction Writers of America. And we've had talks about it. I've talked to a couple of people, and they are considering it. I have the same problem with Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers. Okay. I can't be a member of PAL, which is their professional authors liaison, whatever it is. I can't be a member because I'm not published through the right places. Okay.
So let me just synopsize
Bring
this.
Bring me back, yeah.
Yeah, you're making six figures a year writing science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah.
And yet the powers that be do not consider you an author.
I'm not a professional. I'm good with that.
Okay.
I'm good with that.
It's an appropriate moment to ask, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, that's what we're trying to bring up. But on the other hand, you're one of the success stories, Nathan.
Yeah.
And the next piece we're going to talk about is why you are a success and why you're one out of 1,000 who are a success and the other 999 are not. So you gave me this morning three things that you said made you a good author.
Well, what did I say? I read a lot.
You read a lot. That
I read
was
in the
one.
Field. Okay. I study the field and analyze what I've read. So I find stories that I characterize as stories I want to read that I can't find. And so I write those. What else did I say?
You said you were a professional.
Well, you said I was a professional.
Well, no, we both came up with that.
All right.
All the years that you've written.
I've written a lot.
Nonfiction.
I've written a lot of nonfiction. I was an academic for many years. I was involved as a international level professional in software maintenance. I was a president of the Software Management Association. I wrote a lot of articles about how to do this, that, or the other thing and take care of and account for and do. I did a lot of technical writing in software management before I got into education, and then I wrote a lot of journal articles about how education works and what it does and how you approach that. And I did a lot, and I wrote a 300-page book as a doctoral dissertation. So I've done a lot of nonfiction writing, and I really do. I don't think of it as approaching it as professional because I look at it as approaching it as having fun. Mm-hmm. But I think that might be a really good definition of professional.
And then reading in the field.
And reading in the field, yeah. 40, 50 years
Talk
of reading in the field.
Talk about that for just a minute.
I think it was Connie Willis who said that the arts are, literature in particular, is a slow motion conversation among authors and readers just get to listen in. And so if you don't read in the field, if you don't read in your genre, then you don't know what the conversation is. So, you know, you don't know what anybody else is talking about. And you don't know if you're just repeating what somebody just said or if it's something that has been said so often nobody says it anymore. And so we wind up with a lot of new authors who don't read or haven't read deeply or widely, repeating a lot of the old tropes, the Pocahontas story, the Adam and Eve story. And you see them coming up, new authors in particular. Oh, yeah, cool. Wait till you get to the end. And his name was Adam. Jeez. How many times are we going to have this thing? You know, and bring me something new. If it's going to be the Adam and Eve story, you're going to have to do a lot better than that. The punchline isn't the joke. You gotta give me something. So I once said in an interview that I liked writing science fiction or fiction better than nonfiction because the lit review was shorter. And my wife turned to me and said, "You've been doing that lit review for 50 years, buddy." So yeah, I think it's true. I think you have to read. I think you have to read in the field you want to write in. I think you have to like the field you want to write in. There are a lot of people who are trying to write the field that they write to the market that they think is selling. And it looks like they're writing to the market they think is selling. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. More often, I think it doesn't.
So you write what you love.
I write what I love. I can't.
Do you have fun?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you one last question,
right,
and we're going to open this for a few questions.
No. Because
we've got about 10 minutes left.
All right.
Did you ever think 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when you were a kid on the farm in Maine, that this would happen?
No. Now, I've been through so many changes that I couldn't have imagined having gone through. It makes one of the ongoing conversations that happens in education is how do we train young people to take jobs that don't exist yet, and I look back at my life and look at the jobs that for the last 40 years I've been working in jobs that didn't exist when I was in high school. So we've been doing this all along. It's not a question of how do we do it now, because we didn't know then. The only difference between now and then is we didn't know then that we didn't know. Now we know we don't know what they're going to be doing because we don't know what the jobs are going to be. The idea that I would be making a living off a computer network that spanned the globe from a computer in my basement that cost less than my television set when I was in high school. It's ridiculous. It's insane. It's crazy. There's no way we could have anticipated it. And so, no. I mean, I've been through so many changes. I've had so many different jobs. I've done so many different things. Yeah, there were teachers back then, and I was a teacher for a while. There were stores back then, and I worked in a store. There were writers back then, but there are still writers today. But
the media is different.
The media is very different, and the opportunities afforded by the media, the opportunities afforded by less the media than the distribution. The distribution is really what has changed everything. The media is. We're still telling stories. We went through a phrase where we're talking about new media. And new media, it's not really new media. It's old media. It's just packaged different. It's just delivered differently. And that distribution change is the one that's really the underlying driver here. When you had to put on pants and drive to the store and see whether or not the book you wanted to buy was there, that's very different than I'm just going to order the next volume while I'm laying here in bed. Mm-hmm. That's real different. That's real different. And I think a lot of the mainstream press hasn't really twigged to the fact that the friction in the buying process, the bookstore thing, that's a problem. And they haven't figured out how to fix that yet. But, yeah.
I have a question that segues directly into that. We discussed it earlier. We have so many more means of communication, telephone, internet, et cetera, a lot of people have a cell
phone
in their
pocket.
Okay, but the point I was trying to make, and also the having access to an automobile so you can easily get to places like that, it seems like those conveniences from technology has actually isolated us more than brought us together. It seems that way. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I hear that a lot. But the reality for me, and I realize that it's only for me, and I've sort of grown up with the technology. So the comment I made earlier about I'm not isolated by the technology, I'm isolated when I log off. I have a lot more opportunity to connect with people who have that I share more with than what you call it, geographic identity.
Yeah, geographic affinity.
Geographic affinity. So when I could only talk to the people who lived in my neighborhood, that was maybe 50 people. Now I can talk to a million. Now I can talk to a billion. And a big number of them talk back. And so I think there's this notion that these kinds of barriers that we put up that are glass screens are for many people are barriers. for me, it's not a barrier. It's a window. It's a door. It's an opportunity that didn't exist before. I don't see it as isolating, but I think that might be a particular and peculiar bias that I have.
Are you familiar with the term cocooning?
Yeah. And I know there are people who are cocooning. A lot of people would look at my lifestyle and say I am cocooning because I very seldom leave the house unless it's to take the kid to school, pick her up from school, or go to the grocery store, or come here. But you know, we don't have like house parties. We don't have people over for dinner, and we don't go out with our friends because our friends all live in different countries. They all live in different states. They all live in different states of mind. Some of them. But they're not here. They're not where I can get in a car and drive to them. My nearest family I have to fly to. So it's a very different kind of world for me in terms of my world isn't who lives near me. My world is who I connect to.
Right. Let's get Jack at the back here.
Yeah, I was just to
loudly.
Just to extend that a little bit is this is what the conventions are for, is where we can get the physical togetherness when the rest of the year you're online and talking with people online, but now you get to meet them face to face.
And yet we come to conventions like this, and how many of us are taking time out of our face-to-face convention to sit there with our devices and go back and talk to the people online? So.
Well, I see. I do it to share with them.
Okay. Here?
As a fellow Rocky Mountain Fiction Writer member, I would remind you that you are eligible for iPal now.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, yeah. I am eligible for iPal. And we talked back and forth before, yeah.
Okay. That means that there are some people who consider him a professional writer.
That is correct.
Yay. And we had someone else over here who wanted a question?
Regarding new writers, avoid old trolls, what other advice would you give us?
Finish it.
Okay.
Finish it. I can't tell you the number of people, and I'm active on Google Plus and a lot of writers' groups, and a lot of writers say, well, I've got this great first chapter, but I want to make it perfect before I get to chapter two. And it's like, dude, you know, you can't get a fan for something you're going to write. You can't get a fan for something you're going to write. Finish it. And the other side of that is that you don't know if the first chapter is even the first chapter until you've got to the end. When you get to the end, maybe that's not the first chapter anymore. Maybe it's not even in the book anymore. Finish it. Once you've finished it, then you can go back and say, oh, well, you know, maybe it isn't. I finished one book. Actually, it was Siberia's Call. It was NaNoWriMo project. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is cool. This is it. First act, second act, third act. We got it done, and I got to the end, and I couldn't end it. I couldn't find the end. It was kept going on. It was like, what is going on? I'm weeks into January trying to find the end of this story, and I can't find the end of the story. And it's like, what the? It's the only book I've written. My grammar is rolling over in her grave. It's the only book I wrote that I couldn't find the ending to, and it was because I didn't start it in the right place. And it took me a year to figure out what was wrong with it, and it was because what I thought was the first act was actually the beginning of the second. And so when I got to the end of what I thought was the third act, that was actually the first act in the next book, and it was like... I couldn't find where, you know, logically it's supposed to stop here, but if it stops here, then this whole front thing is wrong, and then why is it wrong? And then I had to realize that it was, okay, I started in the wrong place. But until I got to the end, until I got to the point where I couldn't find the end to tell me that that first chapter was wrong, I still used the chapter. I just, you know, it's like 25% into the book. It's much later down the road. But I didn't know that until I got to the end. And so until you get to the end, you don't know what the story is. A lot of people will plot it out and outline it and do the whole thing, and they'll vary from the outline, and they've got all kinds of mechanisms to do it. But until you get to the end, you don't know what the story is. And you can start thinking you know what the story is going to be, but until you get to the end, you don't know what the story actually is. And so the best advice I can give anybody who's going to write is finish it at least once. Maybe you'll finish it two or three times, but at least finish it, because until you finish it, you can't figure out what it is.
Oh, well, I was just going to make a comment on the earlier thing about talking to people and the communication.
Yeah.
I see that as a way to gain information worldwide in a short period of time, and that's never, you know, it's something I look at as a research kind of thing. I have a friend in Queensland, Australia, this last week, told me about a thing in Rifle, Colorado that I never knew. So I'm going to check that out. And when he comes here, take him there.
Yep.
And then I regularly have conversations with people in northern Tanzania and places like Japan and Italy and places. And you can do it in a quick, be done, yep. And that's it.
Here.
This isn't a new thing. What's new is the extreme availability of this. There's always been on our illiterate class that corresponded across countries and continents.
I won't go for always, but in the last few centuries, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah.
The speed with which we can do it is greatly increased, and the breadth across the level of the population that is able to engage in it now is greatly increased. And those two things represent not just a quantitative change, but I think also a qualitative change.
I think so.
In that people who lived in the metaphorical ivory tower in 1500 didn't actually live, I think, all that differently in the root of their lives than the example of yourself now. That intellectual life is more widely dispersed and more available, but the way in which you live has only changed cosmetically. Yeah, you got better plumbing.
I was just going to say flush toilets.
You got other features like that. But frankly, that's all cosmetic. The life of the mind that's going on inside has simply been multiplied. Not just our population has grown, but our percentage of our population that can do it is now vastly expanded. And that's a wonderful thing.
Look at all the questions we're getting now. We're almost out of time.
We are almost out of time. I'm going to take Robin and then Seamus, and then we're done.
Sorry, I missed the earlier part. I don't know if you touched on this before, but have you ever found your characters doing things you didn't expect them to do?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time. I sit down to write something, and then they do something else. And they're like, what? How is this even possible? How is this? It's like, it's sort of mummery. It's like, how can your puppet do something that your hand isn't shaking for? I don't know. I don't know how it works, but yeah, it happens to me all the time. And quite often, I find that if I come to a point where the writing is sticky and it's not coming out, I write about 1,000 words an hour. And if I find that I've dropped down to, you know, it's been an hour and I've got maybe a paragraph, it's always because I'm trying to get them to do something that they shouldn't be doing. And they're fighting me on it. And it sounds sort of disassociative. But the reality of it is that if I get out of the way and let my creative brain spill the story, it can weave the story a lot better than I can if I try to think about how the story is supposed to go. I mean, one of the ones was in one of the early books, Ishmael finds a tailor, and it's in a flea market, and so it's just this crazy back and forth. And the idea was he was going to go buy a coat, a jacket, because following the old Shakespearean clothes make the man, I wanted to sort of bring this clothing idea in as kind of a sub-theme. And so he was going to go, and I was going to have him go to this place and find this crazy man selling clothes at the flea market, and he was going to buy a jacket. And so I get through this whole chapter, and I get to the end, and he puts the jacket back on the rack and leaves. And I'm like, what the? What happened there? And so, it happens to me all the time. And if the writing's not going well, it's probably because I've not let them do what they're supposed to.
Okay, Seamus?
Yeah, you brought up the concept of cocooning, and I was listening, there was a television program back in the 70s called Connections, and they made the same thing about telephones, everybody had their network and their telephone diary or something of that nature. And the same thing happened back in Newton's, watching a thing about Newton's life. They were totally isolated. A lot of the intellectuals were totally isolated and only used letters. So the communication media basically is this only thing that connects with the rest of the world. And if anything, people are becoming less cocooned because the technology is getting, as I say, closer and closer to real time and more personal.
Well, there's another echo with that, and it's the one I use in distance education all the time, where there's some fear that the network computer is going to replace the teacher and how that's going to interfere with the ability of students to learn. And I always cite Socrates, who was very concerned with the evolution of a new technology that was going to force man to rely on an external storage medium of writing. And
scrolls.
If we, hadn't, if we would had writing, then we wouldn't know that he thought that, because Plato actually recorded it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was one of those very odd echoes that happens quite frequently in social media.
I'm being told that we have about 2 minutes left.
We do.
So I'm going to make one final comment and then ask you for one final comment.
We'll
and my final comment would be sort of with this transitions with history. The fact that you do audiobooks, I think, brings you back to the original storytelling. When I started reading, listening to your audiobooks, you were talking to me.
Yeah.
And it was like sitting there with the storyteller's bowl,
yeah.
And I wanted to put money in it and have you tell me more
stories.
More.
Yeah, I mentioned when we started this, I'm from New England. And New England has a very strong storytelling tradition. I come from that tradition. I identify with it. I like to think that I identify with it closely. The Downey story, where they used to tell tales around the pot-bellied stove and crack the barrel. There wasn't much else to do in the winter because it was too cold to go outside and there wasn't anything out there anyway but snow. And so they'd sit around and they'd tell each other stories, what people from away would call lies. And it would make them all up. It would be some outrageous tales that we would tell around the fire. And so the Marshall Dodge and all of those guys, Tim Sample, and the people who that I grew up with telling Down East stories were sort of the one part of the influence that said, yeah, this telling a story, this idea that I'm going to write a book, yeah, fine, but I'm going to tell the story is really, really the where I go. It's where I'm from.
And we love it, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.